From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on December 25th, 2013, when a Turkish journalist named Mahir Zeynalov tweeted about corruption in the Turkish government. Zeynalov and his colleagues had been following the story of corruption connected to government officials and to Turkish police. The Turkish government had become increasingly hostile to forms of criticism, and before the end of that day, the government was labeling Zeynalov a traitor, not in legal terms, but in undeniable smear terms. And it got worse. Within days, Mahir Zeynalov was told that police would be coming to arrest him. He went into hiding, but he felt he could not hide out forever. By February, Zeynalov was deported by the Turkish government. They claimed that he had crossed the line of acceptable criticism. Turkey is often considered among the more progressive nations in its region, but the crackdowns on press freedom have been increasingly severe. Mahir Zeynalov came to the United States with his family, and he now lives and works in Washington. He continues to write for Turkey's largest daily newspaper from abroad. He blogs for the Huffington Post. He writes for Al Arabiya, and he still tweets. He has more than 100,000 Twitter followers. Zeynalov was in Rochester for a short visit this week as a guest of the Peace Islands Institute as part of the Turkish Cultural Center of Rochester. Last night, Zeynalov was the featured speaker at the Peace Islands Institute's annual friendship dinner. He spoke about press freedom, threats to journalistic enterprise, and what the world can do about it. As you'll find out this hour, he's not calling for extreme measures, but instead believes there are things we all can do to support working journalists. At various points this hour, you will hear our guests refer to Erdogan. That refers to the president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who was previously the Turkish prime minister. To give you a sense of Erdogan's approach to the news media, he banned YouTube in Turkey after a damaging recording of Erdogan leaked to the internet. The Turkish judiciary reversed the YouTube ban, but Erdogan has responded by trying to smear and intimidate journalists who report on corruption. Mahir Zeynalov is perhaps the most prominent case. It's my pleasure to welcome Mahir Zeynalov. Thank you for taking the time not only to come to Rochester, but to come on the program today.
My pleasure.
Journalists have been struggling in a lot of parts of the world. Certainly the Middle East is not the only place. But in Turkey, give me a sense for what happened. And a lot happened on Twitter, of all things. Set the scene for us. What happened?
Well, authoritarian governments, I mean, those governments where corruption is rampant and then nepotism is widespread, they want to hide things and sweep things under the rug. And because of that, they want to crack down on dissent and the media, because that's type of the institution that holds governments and authorities accountable. And in Turkey, actually, Turkey has been doing very good in the past 10 years. And the current government has been undertaking widespread sweeping reforms in line with European Union membership negotiations. But after 10 years in power, the government has started to crumble down, and then they were tired of reforms, so to speak, and they started to intimidate journalists, those who are critical, and they want to and they forced critical news outlets to sell their stakes to friendly business people. And then, of course, there are many journalists, more than 100 journalists were jailed in the past several years. At the moment, there are 10 journalists in jail.
In Turkey.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And, several of them are in jail, not because of their journalistic activities, but, most of them are. And Turkey has a very chronic problem in terms of intolerant stance toward media.
And what happened to you?
Well, actually, it has started when the then Prime Minister, now President, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, pressed criminal charges against me for tweeting a news story that unveiled his corruption, scandal that targeted him and his inner circle. And that was a massive corruption scandal. And on that day, it was December 25th, 2013, pro-government media unleashed a huge, massive smear campaign against me. And that was...
What did they say about you?
Well, one of the headlines read like that, Turkey, beware of this traitor. Okay, that was the headline of a news report.
You were a traitor for pointing out corruption?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
So there were many, many headlines targeting me, just inciting hatred, hate speech, basically. And then on that same day, Erdogan filed a criminal complaint against me. on charges of insulting a public official and also inciting animosity among public. And I was called into police for questioning, and I dismissed charges. I said that, you know, like whatever I tweeted, whatever I wrote are protected, you know, under freedom of speech. And also our constitution, you know, enshrines those kind of freedoms. And then 5 days later, they kicked me out of the country. It was February 2014.
How did they do that? Did they come for you?
No, actually, there was a decision at the Interior Ministry. And then someone, official from the Interior Ministry, I don't know who he is or she is, probably thought that, you know, this is an assault on media freedom. And they called our newspaper, said that police are after Mahir. So just, you know, like, just try to do whatever you can just to hide him or whatever you can do to prevent it. And then usually when you deport someone, you give them at least 1 or 2 weeks, according to Turkish laws, so that they can appeal. And then after we heard that there was a decision to deport me, my editors decided to hide me. And in that period, would be able to appeal. So they didn't give me a chance to appeal the decision. And then I went into hiding for 3 days. And then, but police were after me in a, you know, like in a vociferous way. So I couldn't, you know, like run away.
Where were you hiding out?
I was hiding in one of my friend's house, and then I switched another place, and then, you know, and police didn't know. I mean, I didn't have any electronics, and then my friends deliberately didn't visit me, and then there was somebody whom I didn't know. They just, you know, assigned him to bring me food, and, you know, like, I just exchanged letters, you know, like written letters, you know, like in, because they were just writing stories, and they were just writing background about that. So it was, you know, like 3 days in hiding, just solitary confinement, and the police, you know, couldn't find me. And then we thought that, you know, like, it would be impossible for me to live like that. And then our lawyers decided that maybe I should leave the country, and then they will appeal a decision. And then 5 in the morning, me and my wife surrendered to airport police in Istanbul, and then they just deported me.
You speak very clinically about 3 days in hiding. Were you frightened?
Well, not really, because the most they would just jail me for 15 days because, you know, like, they whenever they decide to deport you, they jail you for like for 2 weeks because, you know, there's an official correspondence because with their country. Do you accept him? Is he your citizen? So that would be maybe traumatic, 15 days in jail. But still, that was the most. But I had, you know, family and friends who were really worried about me. And but of course, you know, like Turkey was my primary residence country, and I had a family there, friends there, and you know, like, it was, you just leave home in the morning, and then that's it. You cannot, you know, like, go back there. And when I left, actually, my office, there was a friend. I told him that, can you please, you know, shut down my computer because I don't have even time to, you know, just to clean up my, you know, office. So in that sense, that was traumatic. And you couldn't say, you know, like, goodbye to your friends. And, you know, I haven't seen them since.
When you tweeted about the Turkish government's corruption, did you know that those tweets could be costly for you?
Well, not really. I mean, I was surprised by the reaction. I know that, you know, it was coming for several months already. To every of my tweets, there were like hundreds of people were just, you know, like swearing, you know, just insulting, just, you know, reacting in a very harsh way. But most of them were trolls or programmed users. But I was so surprised when the programmed media, you know, that launched that smear campaign against me. And then I just thought that, what am I doing? The problem was that, you know, one of the suspects in that corruption investigation was Yasin Al-Qadi, who was listed as a specially designated global terrorist by U.S. Treasury Department. And that was written within the story. When I wrote that, Turkish prosecutors orders police officials to detain these suspects, and then the police officials who were appointed by the prime minister, then Prime Minister Erdogan, refused to comply. When I said that, they were outraged, that as if I'm trying to imply that, you know, Turkish, you know, government is protecting, you know, like a Al-Qaeda link, you know, suspects. So they didn't like it. So that was actually the tipping point. But, you know, like, I was so much surprised that, you know, there was a huge reaction because of that.
We're talking to Mahir Zeynalov, who is a columnist at Al Arabiya, a blogger at The Huffington Post, working out of Washington, D.C. now, and still a correspondent for Today's Zaman. What is Today's Zaman?
Well, today Zaman is a sister English language newspaper of Zaman Daily, which is selling over a million copies a day. It's the best-selling newspaper in Turkey. There are 5 million readers of newspaper readers in Turkey daily, and we're selling like more than a million. So we just share the 20% of the market there.
And so when's the last day again you were in Turkey?
It was 2014, 7th of February.
Okay, so February 7th, and you haven't been back?
No, I mean, I'm actually banned to be back. I cannot even visit the Turkish embassy in Washington because it's considered as a Turkish territory. So I'm actually banned from entering into the country. I'm among the list of foreigners who cannot enter into the country.
Is your case unusual, or are journalists under assault generally in Turkey?
Well, it's not only unusual in Turkey, it's unusual in the world. Deporting a journalist for even tweeting is a measure even authoritarian leaders rarely resort to. I know that Declan Walsh from the New York Times was deported from Pakistan maybe 2 years ago. So there are very few examples in the past two decades. You know, like you've seen, you know, people are being jailed or intimidated, beaten up. But deportation is just very rare because you can't really silence people in that way. Well, in Turkey, according to the latest Freedom Press Index by the Reporters Without Borders, Turkey is placed the 149th out of 108 countries. So it's in the, you know, like at the bottom of the list. And in the Freedom House ranked Turkey as not free country. And the United States says that the State Department says that the freedom of journalists to operate in Turkey is one of their ongoing concerns at the moment regarding journalists.
All right, so journalists are struggling in Turkey to be able to do their jobs, but very rarely or almost never do we see actual deportation.
Right, I'm actually the second case. The first one was in 1995. There was a woman who was deported. I think he was a European national. I'm not real sure. She was deported because, you know, she was writing about Kurdish issues, which was taboo by then. And I think I'm the second one, and maybe the first in two decades.
Mahir, what do you want to do? Do you want to go back to Turkey?
Well, at the moment, not really. I mean, if they even, you know, lift a decision, I will not go back because, you know, like, once you leave the country, I started a, you know, like I have a, you know, like family here already. I have a life here. So, I mean, it will be, again, a start of a new life when I go back to Turkey. And also, it's a very dangerous country for those who are, you know, criticizing the government. And of course, you know, if you go there, it's not an Iraq or Syria or some other, you know, like a typical Middle Eastern countries. I mean, it's just relatively peaceful. It's a stable country, basically.
Right. That's why I think a lot of Americans will be surprised to hear about how rough it is for journalists.
Right. I mean, it's not, I mean, just let me be clear here. I mean, it's not like Egypt when you know, like hear that, you know, somebody got killed or beaten or, you know, there's an explosion in some other countries. It's not like that at all. I mean, it's very peaceful. Even I would say that, you know, in terms of crisis, it's more peaceful than the United States. But the government is not tolerating those who criticize. So you can see, you know, 13 years old, just because of the Facebook post, facing charges on charges of, you know, insulting the public official.
13-year-old on Facebook,
right.
can get legally in trouble for writing a Facebook post.
Yeah, actually,
about,
I mean,
the government.
A 13-year-old kid. So we have a lot of such cases. There are up to 20 articles in Turkish Penal Code that restricts freedom of speech. And there is an article in Turkish Penal Code that says that, you know, like you cannot insult a public official. And I'm also facing charges because of that. I just criticize the government. And then the authorities are using this article to label any kind of criticism, heavy criticism, as such that, you know, as if we are insulting a public official.
That's how they called you a traitor.
Well, I mean, this is not a legal term, obviously. It's just, you know, like the pro-government media is just basically, you know, funded by the government through different ways, like, you know, like getting ads from public institutions and, you know, like publicly owned companies. And, you know, like it's their job, you know, like to just polish the image of the government. And whenever someone is just saying something in Turkey, you know, the authorities, especially the president, is demonizing the people. You know, Erdogan is not a Vladimir Putin of Russia, because Putin just literally kills people. Erdogan demonizes them. And then there's the culture of lynching in the country, that whenever you say something bad about the government, you will have on Twitter, Facebook, on the media, they will just, you know, like go over through your entire, you know, history, your private life, personal life, and then, you know, bring out everything that they can to defame you. And they know the society very well. I'm talking about the authorities. They know what they hate. And then they just, you know, like demonize them, and then whip up that, you know, like rhetoric against them. And then, you know, like if they want to charge anything, now they have the public support.
Is there any public support for you?
It's a very divided society, you know, and I would say that maybe 60% of the Turkish people don't like this government. You know, they're in power because, you know, like we have a parliamentary democracy there, well, semi-democracy. So all these, you know, opposition leader actually backed me up, and several other opposition leaders, you know, like publicly criticized that. There were many public figures who criticized that, and they represent, you know, some portion of the society. There have been, you know, like my case was, you know, trending on Twitter. People were just lashing out at that. And internationally, obviously, like many rights groups and the press advocacy bodies were rallying behind me, and they were just criticizing and condemning the government for doing that. The United States State Department said that, described this as unsettling. And so the United Nations criticized that. So there had been, you know, like a domestic and international support, and which was, you know, like a big consolation for me at that time.
We're talking to Mahir Zenilov, who is a correspondent for Today's Zaman. It's a Turkish newspaper, widely read in Turkey, a columnist of Al Arabiya, and a blogger at Huffington Post, who has experienced, I would say, just about the worst of what journalists could experience in Turkey, being deported, now living in Washington, D.C., and speaking about the importance of a free press. So how do we make change here?
Well, it's our job to speak up. You know, like when you look at Turkey, you have, you know, vibrant media. At least, you know, there are hundreds of journalists who, you know, write critically. There are TV channels who, you know, broadcast in a critical way. And it's not another Uzbekistan or Turkmenistan or China where the media is entirely silenced. It's because we are struggling. It's, you know, authoritarian regime in the making, not really there. So that's why we are struggling. When we are struggling, you know, you have a number of cases of intimidation, you know, jailing. And because of the journalists, brave journalists who are speaking up, raising their voice louder, the government is just, you know, like becomes paranoid and then just, you know, attacks and assaults, you know, the media just because of that. And so I think it's the right way to do. And it will be, you know, we have elections in 2 months, and we'll see what the outcome of the elections are. If the government gets really huge blow, then, you know, they will understand that something is going wrong. Turkey is not, you know, another Middle Eastern country. It has, you know, vibrant society and, you know, like civil society organizations that are in the thousands. And we have a, you know, like a tradition of democracy since 1950s. Although that was interrupted by 4 military coups, but at least, you know, like it's not similar to Pakistan or Afghanistan or some other country. We have a solid, you know, state traditions and a civil society tradition. And I believe that, you know, like if we keep silent because the crackdown is escalating, then it will give an incentive to the government to do more, to further their ideals and ambitions for power. But if we keep fighting, and that fighting would be through just, you know, like speaking out, no matter what the consequences are, taking the risks. And I believe that will be a very effective way of, you know, like fighting what's going on there.
Well, you came to Rochester for the Peace Islands Institute's annual dinner. And when you talk about speaking out, I know you're speaking about the Turkish people, but you're talking about people around the world in solidarity, aren't you?
That's correct. I mean, only in the past, you know, like 3 or 4 years, more than 200 journalists were killed, and 500 of them are jailed. So it's not. I mean, it has been the worst period ever in the modern history because of the, you know, conflict in the Middle East. Only in Syria last year, 70 journalists were killed. And obviously, it's not about Turkey. And Turkey, it's a pole star for other countries. You know, if we have democracy and, you know, human rights and the media freedom in Turkey, the other Muslim countries can copy that. You know, they are not going to copy Western democracies because they believe that, you know, like they have different culture. But if Turkey is successful at that, and our fight in Turkey in that regard will be exemplary for those countries. And of course, you know, like we're in solidarity with other journalists. And I'm lucky that I'm here in Washington. I can speak up. It's easier here. You know, we don't have any kind of intimidation. But not many people as lucky as I am. After I left several months later, you know, police raided our newspaper and detained briefly for a week our editor-in-chief. and many other journalists were detained and then they released. But you know, they are, you know, like a living hell out there. It's not the case for the entire Turkish society, definitely. You are totally fine, you know, like if you are just in terms of in good terms of the government. But if you speak out, you know, there are consequences, not for all of them. But, you know, if you are visible and if you are in the media, if you are very effective on Twitter or Facebook, you know, like it's highly likely that you will face consequences.
It would be easier for people like you just to do other things. And I suspect governments in power would prefer journalists like you to give up and to do other things. Have you ever thought about that?
Well, actually not, because, you know, like journalism is not a job that, you know, like you do it just to make money, because you can't. You know, there are many journalists who make money, but, you know, like there are only few. So it's very similar to, you know, like a Hollywood jobs, you know, like it's a secondary tire, you know, glamour job, you know, like you'll just do whatever you can, you know, like when you get into that industry. But, you know, once you see that the beauty of it, that, you know, like you are actually not making enough money, but you sacrifice a lot, and we're like firefighters, you know, like sometimes 3 a.m, there's something coming out and I have to wake up and, you know, cover that story. And when you see that, you know, whatever you write or say have an impact and make change, and then when you see that you disturb some people, you disturb some institutions just because what you write and say, and it makes difference in your life too. It makes your life meaningful. So in that sense, you know, I've never thought, you know, like to shifting my job, because, you know, like I'm not doing journalism just, you know, like to make more money or to be more comfortable. Just to have an impact and to make some changes. So in that sense, you know, I haven't thought anything about that.
How does the media in this country, how does the media do in your eyes at covering issues related to the Islamic faith?
Well, obviously there are a lot of, you know, biased coverage. And, you know, there are many informed journalists out there. And thankfully there are many, many journalists in the Middle East who are reporting back here. But still, there are lots of shortcomings, especially, you know, like there's bias, you know, like against, you know, Muslim communities here in the United States. It's because, you know, they don't have informed comment. You know, like I would not underestimate, you know, like what's going on here regarding the, you know, like the treatment of Muslims and how they view Islam. Some of them are, you know, some of the TV networks are, you know, driven by, you know, like a corporate interest. And then some of them are not really, you know, like just, you know, like doing journalism just to get the story out there, but to, you know, like make the headlines. And they will highlight some stories that, you know, don't deserve to be highlighted. So in that sense, you know, like a public has kind of a, you know, like a view that kind of a conviction that, you know, this is good or this is bad. And because, you know, like when you have fear among people, you know, like it's just, you know, we have a famous saying that, you know, it bleeds, it leads when it bleeds.
If it bleeds, it leads.
Right. Yeah. So in that regard, you know, like whenever you just say that, you know, they are coming, whenever you instill fear among people, your stories will sell. So, I mean, I think that's, I'm not sure if it's deliberate or not, and I hope it's not. This kind of, you know, like a fear mongering is going on. You know, there are many, many cases out there, like ISIL, which is not a national security threat at all to the United States, but to Turkey, to Iraq, Syria, to many other countries in the neighborhood. But, you know, like in Turkey, you will see maybe like one story out of 10 about ISIL. But here you can see, you know, like nine stories out of 10 about ISIL. So it makes headlines here. So in that sense, that fear mongering is very high here. And that actually creates bias among public.
The story of ISIS or ISIL was a cover story in the Atlantic Monthly with the title, What ISIS Really Wants. And the writer, Graham Wood, wrote a story, 10,000 words, saying that ISIS is Islamic. It's not that it is the only version of Islam, but they are true believers in some very sort of backward view of what they perceive Islam to be. Is ISIS or ISIL Islamic?
Well, I would not call them Islamic, but Islamist, because, you know, like Islamic means like, you know, they are following the traditions of the Prophet Muhammad or Quran, the holy Muslim book. I think, you know, they are Islamist in a sense that they're trying to impose their own ideology on others. And it's in the essence of Islam that actually leaves you out there. They just, you know, like it's the job of Muslims that they call jihad, to promote Islam, to tell them that, you know, like what's good or what's bad, and say that, you know, this is Islam, this is the main pillars. But then if you force them to do this kind of stuff, to impose your ideology or your belief onto them, so it's actually against the spirit of Islam. That's what, you know, they want to do. And they have no idea about Islam. You know, they have been doing many, many things that, you know, like even if you go to a mountain in a Muslim country and ask, you know, like a Muslim there, parochial Muslim there, they will just say that, no, this is not Islam. I mean, killing, beheading journalists. I mean, I can tell you that 99.9% of Muslims would just reject them, reject their ideology. And, you know, 126 Islamic scholars, you know, wrote a joint letter, I think, like a, I don't know, 20-page letter, just to convince the youth, radicalized youth, that, you know, this is not the way to go. And they're just, you know, brainwashed. It's not because they are Muslims that they are doing that. It's because, you know, Muslim societies are oppressed under, you know, like authoritarian regimes. And then, you know, we have seen lots of other, you know, like Christians and Jewish, actually, the groups who have resorted to, you know, terrorism because they were either under, you know, like foreign governments. I mean, in Israel, you know, like we had, you know, like, you know, two, you know, the people who were just, you know, like killing in a terroristic way, and they have become the prime ministers of Israel later. And then we have, you know, in Ireland, because, you know, like they are being oppressed, so they want to express their, you know, like I'm not trying to justify terrorism or anything. I'm just trying to say that, you know, like this is not really related to Islam in any way. It's just, you know, like they are just oppressed and they want to express their, you know, like the ideas and their grievances in a violent way. So this is not related to Islam. And most Islamic societies, you know, most of them, almost all of them, they just reject their ideology.
Finally, living in Washington and now having a chance to have worked as a journalist in Turkey and now in Washington, D.C., and seeing what our Washington, D.C. press corps looks like a little closer. If you polled Americans, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with American news media these days. Is our news media as free as it should be? Is it functioning in the way that you think a free society's press should function?
I would not say that it's not free, but I would say that, you know, like sometimes they're irresponsible, you know, because when that, you know, like a pressure or the censorship comes from the authorities or from other corporations or, you know, like public institutions, it's problematic, it's troubled. But when it comes from a journalist, you know, like if I write a story, I should make sure that, you know, like if I fact check it, if it's correct, and then I should make sure that, you know, like if people are really interested in that, am I trying to, you know, like distort the story in this or that way, spin the truth? So if you don't actually put them, you know, like as your guiding principles, but, you know, like can I sell the story? You know, like will it lead? You know, like because the guiding principles is just ratings and other kind of and understandably so, because, you know, they have to make money. So then, you know, like they have to spin the truth somehow. So in that sense, you know, like we need responsible journalism here rather than a free media. Actually, the United States, you know, like media is one of the freest in the world, maybe after, you know, Britain. But there are some, you know, like troubled cases of, you know, like the Obama administration is just, you know, trying to, you know, like pressure journalists to just, you know, like unveil their sources. But there are very, you know, like minimal cases, not compared at all to, you know, what we are seeing in other parts of the world.
Thank you for being here, and thank you for your perspective and enlightening our listeners as not only your story, but the story of journalism around the world.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Let me turn the discussion now to Bülent Özdemir, the director of the Turkish Cultural Center of Rochester and with the Peace Islands Institute. They're the ones who brought Mehir Zeynalov to Rochester this week. Bülent Özdemir, thank you for being a guest on Connections.
Thank you for inviting us.
Well, first of all, tell us what the Peace Islands Institute is.
Peace Islands Institute is a non-profit, non-governmental organization which is established in 2008 to promote peace and dialogue among the society, starting from the local to the global, by providing or promoting peace and dialogue and friendship with the spirit of mutual understanding and respect. So we do try to address the issues starting from our local community to the global community, which is relating to our society. You know, our society is facing every day with.
And who was behind the founding of the Peace Islands Institute?
Fethullah Gulen is the name, who is the inspiration source of our institution. He's a Turkish Muslim scholar. He's an author of over 60 books. He's an educational activist. He's promoting dialogue and peace, by inspiring people all over the world. Those people have found many institutions, starting from educational institutes to dialogue institutions all over the world.
And I imagine here in 2015, you feel the need is greater than ever, especially with the way the world is looking at the conversations about the Islamic faith, Islamic people. Sometimes we talk about the Islamic world as if it's one place, very single block, as opposed to thinking a little bit more culturally diverse.
That's true. It is very hard at this time, especially what has been happening all around the world, starting from those, unfortunately, Middle Eastern countries, especially Muslim countries. And there have been events happening, violence happening, and those, in between those, there has to be some kind of a point of view or some kind of an approach that needs to address what the real Islam is all about and what is the services to human being and how we can help the others to get rid of all these troubles in all around the world.
What's the biggest misunderstanding that Americans have right now, Bulent?
Well, what we state is not only Americans, but all over the world, the people has four big problems. As this is also our, our mission, in our mission, which are the disunity, poverty, ignorance, and welfare. So these four problems, I would say, are kind of a problem of all the humanity. But in the United States, after especially 9/11 and few of those, extreme events happened, violence happened in different parts of the country, ignorance may be one of the problems, I would say. There are much more kind of a nationalist approach to those issues have been started, unfortunately.
How often do you experience stereotyping or do you struggle at all here in Rochester? Do you experience it?
I personally did not experience much of the stereotypes. Mm-hmm. But because of most probably our duty, our job, our intention to bring people together from all walks of life, all perspectives of life, sit them around the same table and discuss them, have them an opportunity to discuss the different problems, and which helps us to really promote friendship, which is the first step of bringing people together on the same table, which starts to build the friendship, build the dialogue in between all these, different, individuals from different points of view and voices.
Talking to Bulent Özdemir, who is the executive director of the Turkish Cultural Center of Rochester and with the Peace Islands Institute. And this year, for your annual event, you brought in Mihir Zeynalov. Tell us why you wanted Mihir to be here and tell us all the issues that have led up to his appearance here.
Well, first of all, this is our 11th annual Friendship Dinner and Award Ceremony. We have been organizing this for 11 years now. And we have addressed many different issues till now. Last year, our topic was the education. And this year, we wanted to address freedom of press because of what has been going on all around the world, especially from starting from Turkey in nation, which is our heritage as a Turkish American. So we wanted to address those issues all around the world, what has been going on against freedom of press, against human services, against democracy and rule of law, which we experience in Turkey. And that's why we wanted to address that issue at our friendship dinner this year. And we have invited such a guest speaker. He's a correspondent to Zaman Newspaper International, to Washington, D.C. So he's also experienced that situation in Turkey. He's one of the veteran journalists who was kicked out of Turkey because of those problems in Turkey.
There is perhaps some surprise for those who aren't following day-to-day, week-to-week events in Turkey. Sometimes the Americans think of Turkey as more progressive. Do you think Americans would be surprised by what journalists are suffering?
I believe that they are going to be surprised. what have been going on, especially in part of the world, especially in Turkey and all around the world.
If our listeners want to get involved with Peace Islands Institute, the Turkish Cultural Center, or just become a more active community in across cultures locally, what would you have people do?
Well, we have a location in Greece on Dewey Avenue, 2692 Dewey Avenue. We have the Turkish Cultural Center Rochester building over there. We have four different cultural centers, and the Peace Islands Institute is located in that building, renting out of a room in the facility. So they would either go to our website, peaceislands.org, or they can visit us at our facility, and we can invite them to. It's open to public. I mean, we can invite any of our events, everybody who is interested in.
When you hear Mahir speak about what he has gone through and what journalists in Turkey are going through, how does it move you personally?
I am impressed. I mean, I was impressed at the beginning, and I was in Turkey last year, last summer. And in fact, I was following up with the news as well as I am following up every day in here. And it was tough times, and it has been getting worse, unfortunately, especially from the media perspective. And when I heard the story of those journalists have been detained because of their statements or comments against the Erdogan's leaders or, cabinet and the leaders in the cabinet of Erdogan was acting against democracy, against freedom of press, freedom of, rule of law. Because of these corruptions or different kind of, relations which tied them up, in fact, they tied themselves up in. It is very impressive to hear those stories, and it is kind of a sad and unfortunately, all our prayers with them, and we are trying to do as much as possible to have people hear about it.
Well, as he said, we can all show solidarity by speaking out against the tamping down of freedom of the press, of the way journalists are treated around the world. And we can look at journalists killed in Syria, but even journalists like Mahir in Turkey, deported, not allowed to practice their trade, not allowed to talk about the government or point out corruption. He's asking people to show that kind of solidarity around the world, and it looks to me like you and the Turkish Cultural Center and the Peace Islands Institute are carrying out that ideal. So thank you for bringing the story to us, and we look forward to continuing the discussion here on Connections.
Well, I would like to thank you again for inviting us here for this program on the behalf of the Turkish Cultural Center of Rochester and the Peace Islands Institute. We have a lot to do. It's obvious that, we need to do more of these programs to bring people together, create those friendship atmosphere, create those platforms to, help people together to address those issues, that our society is facing with every day, starting from our local community to the global community. That's how we're going to, clear up those stereotypes and problems all over the world.
Up next on Connections, we check in with a hardworking American journalist. We'll talk to Karen DeWitt, our Capitol Bureau correspondent, about a number of state issues. Coming up in our second hour, Hillary Clinton did not tip when she went to Chipotle for lunch. So what? Well, some say it's a scandal. Is the American media silly the way we cover politicians? We'll talk about that, and we'll also talk about the etiquette of tipping. Just where are you supposed to tip anyway? Getting coffee? Going to Chipotle? Getting your hair cut? What are the standards now? Join the conversation next hour.
Who needs passwords when you can use biometrics? Those include your voice.
My identity is secure because my voice is my passport.
Your face or fingerprint. Each is unique, but not foolproof.
Either a password or a biometric can be stolen, but only the password can be changed.
Risks and rewards of a biometric boom. Later today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, joined now on the line by our Capitol Bureau correspondent, Karen DeWitt in Albany. Karen, how are you?
I'm very good, Evan.
Well, I know you can only catch part of that last conversation, but I will say that, as an American journalist, I feel so fortunate at times when you hear the plights of people like Mihir Zainulov who've been deported from their home country. And I always think it's important to ask if the media is treated fairly and appropriately, but makes me count my blessings. What do you think, Karen?
Well, yeah, our complaints seem small compared to that. Although, that said, but reporters here at the Capitol have been particularly shut out of events lately as these scandals keep growing and growing here, so that we could use a little more democracy in New York State government.
I did want to talk about that, and I don't want to talk about this in a way that minimizes any other nation's journalistic press, but I think, whether it's the Obama administration trying to shake out sources from reporters or perhaps what we're seeing in Albany, I'm not comparing it to other countries, but how is the state of play for journalists right now, Karen?
Well, it's a little bit difficult right now because, as you know, former Assembly Speaker was arrested, had to resign. Now there's word in the New York Times that the head of the Senate, Senator Skelos, is being looked at by a grand jury over some of his business dealings. And it seems like the lawmakers here, they're kind of closing ranks. They're feeling very persecuted right now and kind of like victims. And they think it's just a case of an overzealous federal prosecutor and a complicit media. And their attitude is kind of like, we haven't done anything wrong. This, prosecutor's out of hand, and the media just goes along with whatever he says. So that's kind of, their mental state, right or wrong. And it is making it harder for us to cover things. You get little jeers, little taunts, key lawmakers just avoiding us, Senator Skelos gave us the slip earlier in the week by essentially pretending that they were still in the closed-door party conference by leaving the door closed and keeping the Senate guards out, which is a sign that they're meeting, and instead they all snuck out the back door. So things like that are going on. They feel like they're really under siege right now because of just this terrible cloud of scandal that is over Albany right now.
Well, you mentioned Senator Skelos, and we've heard reports of Senator Skelos. They're looking at him, his son.
Yeah.
What else is in the air right now that we should be looking for in the coming days and weeks?
Well, you also have the second in command in the Senate, Senator Tom Libous of Binghamton. His son is in trouble and is going to be sentenced in a couple of days. He sent letters, asking that his son not go to prison because Libous has cancer and says now in these letters that he doesn't know how long he has to live. I mean, it's very, very sad, and we feel badly for Senator Libous, personally with his illness. But on the political spectrum, it means that his seat could be empty. And Senator Skelos' seat could be empty, say, if he's indicted and convicted. And the Republicans control the Senate by a 32-seat majority, which is, the smallest number of senators that you can have to still have the majority. So it looks like this could be the beginning of the end, and especially if the top two go out under a cloud, it might be easier for Democrats to win those seats, even though they may be heavily Republican districts. So I think the Senate Republicans they're kind of acting like, they're trying to put a good front on it, but they've had these long, lengthy, closed-door meetings, and some of them look very glum, like they think their days may be numbered as being the party in power.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the leader of the Senate, Senator Skelos, perhaps following Sheldon Silver's fate, as Sheldon Silver no longer leading the assembly as he did for more than 20 years.
Yes. You're right. There would be pressure on Senator Skelos to leave, but I don't think it'll be as much pressure as the assembly Democrats who really just turned against Speaker Silver and just wanted him out, and within 2 weeks he was gone.
And Karen, of course, they elevated Carl Hastie to the position of Speaker, and I remember asking Joe Morelli, the Assembly Majority Leader then and now, who wanted that position but then supported Carl Hastie. I said, this feels like it happened very quickly, and on the heels of someone leaving because of an ostensible scandal, don't you want to really vet somebody? That's not to say that Carl Hastie's done anything wrong, but there have been questions related to Moreland, related to account expenses and other things. Don't you just want to be sure? And Mr. Morelli told me, number one, I know Carl, I trust him, and number two, I figure if anything comes out, the media will do that work. It was an interesting response. What's been what has unfolded since?
Especially since the media did do the work. The New York Times once again had a story that said accused Hastie of profiting from his mother's crime of embezzlement. She embezzled a lot of money. She was convicted of it. A judge said that they would have to sell the family home to pay for it. His mother died, and Hastie says his attorney said, oh, you don't have to sell the house now. That's all off. But it turns out the attorney was politically connected, and some of the paperwork involving this mysteriously disappeared. This was before Hastie was an assemblyman, but he was very connected with the head of Bronx politics then, Larry Seabrook, who is now in jail for corruption. So a number of questions were raised. Hastie and his people were very angry about this. They said it was a very unfair story, but there are some unanswered questions as to, you know, why he didn't sell the house and, you know, where this paperwork mysteriously disappeared. So, and especially in this atmosphere, that kind of thing's going to get a lot more scrutiny, and it has got a lot of play this week.
Yeah, the game plan is always to be angry and offended that anyone would even raise the question of impropriety.
And that goes back to what I was saying at the beginning, where they're just all kind of acting like they're victims and persecuted around here.
I say this for Republicans and Democrats. I don't care if they feel like victims. Scrutiny is important, and it is more important now than ever with all of the cloud of suspicion of corruption. So if they're clean, they'll be clean. They'll be found to be clean. They don't need to be upset that people are asking questions.
And they didn't take a lot of time to pick Carl Hastie. It was done, you know, didn't make a pun on his name, hastily. Within 2 weeks, they were going to have some public hearing to talk about it, and then all of a sudden, Hastie got all the votes, and, you know, there he was as Speaker, and he wasn't well vetted, and, you know, that could happen in any of those cases. Maybe they should have looked more carefully at who they wanted to be in the job.
Talking to Karen DeWitt, our Capitol Bureau correspondent. A few more minutes, and a lot of the talk now is on possible legislation regarding opt-outs, the opt-out movements. Right now is the second day of 3 days of the state math exams. Last week was the English language arts. Up to 200,000 students sat those out. Karen, what's going on in Albany with that?
Well, the latest is the Regents Chancellor, Merrill Tisch, says that she believes she has the power to delay the implementation of these teacher evaluations for another year. The governor's office says, no, she doesn't have that right. She can do it only if schools demonstrate a particular hardship. But she says that, you know, I've been talking to the schools, and most of them just say they just can't put this in place by the November deadline, and it should not be tied to increased aid for schools, which it is. If they don't do it by November, they don't get some of their increases. They'll get their regular school aid, but they won't get some special increases in school aid. So I'm not sure what's going to happen next with that. It's sort of a stalemate now, a legal interpretation of the law. And, you know, unless somebody goes to court, is the governor willing to take the Board of Regents to court? I'm not sure about that. We haven't heard much except for just a statement from the governor's counsel, but it seems like there's definitely a different interpretation of a law that was passed less than a month ago that, frankly, seems to just be falling apart.
Do you think the Cuomo administration was caught off guard by, I mean, look, last year there were maybe 5% opting out, and this year we knew the numbers would be higher, but 30% across the state, 36% in Monroe County outside the city of Rochester, 60% plus in some suburban districts. Has that caught the governor's office off guard, you think?
I think it did. I think that it did. I don't think they knew how many people were going to opt out, even though there were warnings and people were telling reporters they're just going to be amazed at how many people opt out of this thing. They have no idea. But, you know, I think they had some idea, but not at this scale that seems to derail, you know, these possible teacher evaluations, because they're going to be based on these tests. And if kids don't take the test, how are you supposed to measure it?
Yeah, and so lastly there, it almost seems like calling a bluff. We've heard superintendents in our area say, you know, we called the governor's bluff. They didn't think that a lot of people would actually opt out the way that it has happened, and now there's no way they could use these tests in any meaningful way. And will the state fire back and say, too bad, we'll use them anyway? It's going to be fascinating, but I think it's still unclear at this point.
Yeah, no, I think it is a terrible model. And I think part of the problem is the governor made it so personal against the teachers and their union that things got a little bit out of hand during the budget talks and, you know, putting this policy into place. Maybe if they had said you have 2 years, as Merrill Tisch, the Regents Chancellor, is saying, maybe that would have worked better. But the governor just seemed determined. He wanted to ram that through. He was pretty angry at the teachers' union. They've run all kinds of ads against him and just had this whole like public campaign against him that it became kind of personal. And so maybe he sort of lost sight of the best way to do it. Mm. But it does seem like they're going to have to delay it for a year, however it comes out in the wash.
Karen, thanks for the time. Last question. Do you tip when you go to Chipotle?
I've never been to Chipotle, but I feel like when in doubt, I'm always one who tips.
When in doubt, leave a tip.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, that's our lead into the next hour. I don't know if it should be the scandal that the media tried to make it with Hillary Clinton, though, but that's...
Probably not.
We'll tackle that there. Karen, always great to catch up with you, and I know there's a lot going on there in Albany. We'll be looking for more of your coverage. Thank you for the time.
Soon. Yeah. Bye.
Karen DeWitt reporting from Albany this hour, and yes... we're talking about the faux scandal of Chipotle. What is going on in the media that it's like we've learned no lessons? People say they get tired of this stuff. The media makes it a scandal anyway. Whew. We're going to talk Chipotle and tipping etiquette next hour right here on Connections.